This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Like when we talk about belonging, when we talk about inclusion, I always say you don't have to agree with people, right? You don't have to like what they believe or like how they live. And, you know, we have to be able to get along. So it's okay, all right, that's who you are. I'm just going to keep my distance a little bit, but I don't need to harm you.
Hello, everyone. Takaho.
Selamat datang.
Konnichiwa.
Hola.
안녕하세요.
Assalamualaikum.
And kia ora.
Kia ora, everyone. Welcome back to Connecting Cultures Features. Today, we're here with Anjum Rahman from the Inclusive Aotearoa to talk about the hashtag No Harm Wear campaign with Amnesty International Aotearoa New Zealand. Kia ora. Assalamualaikum, Anjum.
Oh, waalaikum salam. Kia ora koutou.
We actually had a chat before many years ago during my first year of working at ORFM. So I'm very excited to have this chat again. Yeah, just to revisit the conversations that we had. And you are a very remarkable and busy person. So I really appreciate you making time to chat with us. Maybe this is a good chance to reintroduce yourself to our listeners.
Tēnā koutou katoa. He uri tēnei no inia, ko kamo shamim rawa ko Anisu Rahman o ko kaumatua, ko kirikiri roa toku whatumanoa, ko Waikato te awa e mahia nei a kumaharahara, kei kirikiri roa aho e noho ana inaenei, ko Anjum Rahman toku ingoa. No reira, tēnā koutou katoa. And I would also like to acknowledge Mana Whenua, and where I'm sitting is Ngāti Wairere, Ngāti Hawa and Ngāti Mahanga, and also to acknowledge the Kingi Tanga and Te Ariki Nui Ngā Waihonui Te Pō. I'm sure Mana Whenua is different for where you're sitting, but my pepeha talks about how I was born in India. But we arrived here in Kirikiriroa, Hamilton, in 1972. So this is my place of belonging, about five-minute walk from my house is the Waikato River. Wow. And so that's the river that I feel closest to. Yeah, when we came to the city, we were the first Muslim family to settle permanently here. And at that time, there wasn't really anyone else, so we used to go up to Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland, quite a bit. But there were families in the Waikato, like in Ngarua, Wahia, and Putaruru, that we would visit as well. But what that meant was that my parents were quite integral in establishing community here. The first Friday prayers and Eid prayers were in our house. My mom used to clean the house on Thursday night and then cook lunch Friday morning so that all the people that came, because she knew they were using their lunch break to come for prayers, so she made sure that they had a hot lunch ready for them. So, you know, that was so sweet. So I did grow up here. I did my studies here mostly. For a lot of my career, my paid work has been as a chartered accountant. But I was always involved in community. And I think, you know, I know that I got that from my parents and seeing how involved they were. So I was quite active with the Islamic Women's Council, especially from when it started up. I was like first secretary and later became chair for a bit, and for many years did the media spokesperson role. And at the time that the Christchurch mosque attacks happened, I was basically assistant chair, but then our chair, you know, she lost her son in the attacks, and her husband was also shot but survived. So I was asked to step into that role. So I did that for a couple of years. And yeah, as you can imagine, they were difficult years dealing with the Royal Commission, dealing with government agencies. And in the middle of all of that, was trying to set up Inclusive Aotearoa Collective Tahono, because I really saw that the solution to what happened in Christchurch needed to go beyond just our community. Because while that person attacked our community, it was still an attack on the whole country as well. Because so many people, you know, felt impacted by, obviously, you know, the people that were directly impacted the most. But the waves, you know, the outer waves of that hit a lot of people. And so I thought, you know, we need a whole of community response to this. And my goal really was, how can we bring different communities together? And by that, I don't mean like ethnic communities, ethnic minority communities. I mean all the different types of ways that people are different. So whether they have a disability or whether, you know, even if they're from the rainbow community or rural sector, different ages, different socioeconomic backgrounds, how can we try and bring people together across all the various differences and work together to try and push back against this kind of hatred? So really, that was the goal, and that's why I set this up separately, because I wanted to be something that was about the whole of Aotearoa New Zealand. And so we did get started in 2019 and amongst everything else. And I still remember that year, like from 15th of March to 15th of December 2019, I think I had 5 days where I didn't work.
Mm.
Like, and I mean, even then, I know other community leaders that worked harder than me, you know. So it was a lot of stress. And we were like removed from the tragedy in that we weren't there. And it didn't happen to us, even though we knew people that died.
That's a good breakdown of how Inclusive Aotearoa was formed and the backstory of how much work was put into starting it amidst a really important and tough time for a lot of communities. I actually want to go back and talk about your personal belonging in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I love when you shared about your parents opening their homes to the communities for Friday prayers, especially being one of the rare Muslim people at that time in Hamilton. I think it's a really important thing to be able to host communities a safe space. And I think you're doing that very well with Inclusive Aotearoa. And it probably came, that motivation and inspiration probably came from your parents as well, because they held that space for their communities. What was belonging like for you growing up in New Zealand? Because you came to Aotearoa when you were 5 years old, and you have made Aotearoa home for you. So can you tell us what that was like?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think one of the things that my parents had is that they grew up in India. And they're both born in village, so they grew up in village life. And I think what they had was at least a secure sense of their own identity and who they were and who they wanted to be. Even in India, you know, they were a minority community. And I remember when I went back to the village one time and somebody, some old woman that had known my dad growing up, said, oh, he always wanted to leave India. He always wanted to get out and experience the world. Like, you know, he had his dreams and aspirations. But when they came here, you know, they were very grounded. Especially my mum. Actually, my mum was the one that was stronger in her Muslim identity. And so they had that base to work from. Whereas for myself, you know, coming here as a five-year-old, I didn't have that, because you don't at that age. Mm. And so then I come into this world where there's really nobody looking like me, nobody having the experience that I have. And in the schools that I went to, like, there was just a whole lot of ignorance. Like, people just weren't used to. Like, when I went to two primary schools, in my second primary school, I was the only child that wasn't Māori or Pākehā. And so that was really, really isolating. And then I went to intermediate school, and that was worse. I got bullied a lot, not physically, but, yeah, verbally, just teased, isolated, excluded. And I think those experiences kind of just, like, settle into you, and it's very hard to move out of that space. So I think I was pretty awkward as a teenager, but when I went to high school, things were better. And then when I got to university, I found my people, which is basically kids who had grown up here from migrant parents, of whom there was, you know, not a whole lot of those types of people either, because that was, you know, the 80s. But we understood what it was like to live in two cultures and to have, you know, parents who are strongly grounded, very strong in their faith and culture, and then living in this world where everyone is pushing us to conform and be like them because they don't know how to deal with difference. And so I think that really helped. But really, I think I don't feel like I gained any level of confidence until, and it's odd to say this, but there was various things happening, but when the World Trade Center and Pentagon attacks happened in 2001 in the US, there was like this whole huge negative spotlight that was shone onto the Muslim community, and suddenly we were these violent terrorist people and who treated women badly, and all the tropes, everything that you could think of was being said about us. And in the midst of all of that, because 2001, 2002 was worse actually, because then there was the Bali bombing in Indonesia. And for the people here, Bali is a tourist spot that so many of them go to, so it felt so much closer to home. And the hostility was so high. But, yeah, towards the end of 2001, I decided to start wearing hijab. And it was such a huge thing for me because up until then I'd always wanted to just be in the background. I don't want to stand out. I don't want to look different. I don't want to be different. And so even though I believed in it, I didn't have the strength to do it. And so then I decided to be my own person.
So you started wearing the hijab while people were talking about Muslims.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, like it was really awkward at work because they'd hired me as someone who didn't wear a hijab, and because in accounting, you know, you're dealing with clients all the time, and I think they were really worried in this environment how the clients were going to deal with it. So the first week was really difficult. And then I kind of thought, well, I went back to my own faith in the sense of, why am I doing this? If I'm doing it for God, then God will help me through this, and that helped me relax. And once I relax, the people around me relax, you know, because I'm not uptight and nervous anymore, and so they became more comfortable, and I never looked back in terms of that. It has meant, and you will know from your own experiences, and, you know, most Muslim women will tell you their experiences of being visibly different and visibly Muslim, that you do get different types of discrimination and harassment out and about. But at the same time, you know, as the illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq happened, as the invasion of Afghanistan happened, people were reaching out as well. And at that time, I started getting so many invitations to speak, and people were curious and they wanted to know who we were. And I still remember, and I think it was around the time of the invasion in Iraq, and we had all these women who wanted to meet with some women, and they came to the mosque with flowers for us, like hand-picked flowers, not even bought flowers. They hand-picked flowers and they brought them to the mosque as a gesture of peace and, you know, reaching out. So all of those things were happening at the same time as well. So it's always this real mix, and that's that's what Aotearoa New Zealand is.
Yeah.
You see the best and the most beautiful of everything, and you see the harshness of things, and that's, you know, that's the world that we live in, I guess. But in a way, it's that that has always given me hope and given me inspiration that, you know, we're lucky to be here in this country and we have to do what we can. When we think of all the other places the people are born and have to grow up and what they have to deal with, that even when things are tough here, you know, there's still always the ability to make a difference. And so, yeah, I think most of my life it's just that. It's like, how can I use my voice? How can I persuade? How can I shift people? How can I help organize? Mm. I don't see myself as a leader. I really hate, like, you will find me, I very rarely will take the chair's position or president's position. I don't want to be a CEO of anything. Leadership has always sat very uncomfortably with me. But if you want me as a supporting role, then that's where I'm happy. Yep, I can help out. I can, as long as someone else sits at the top, I'm very happy to help out. And even in our team, you know, because when I started it, I was the lead and I struggled so much. And then we moved to a co-lead situation. So we would have a tangata whenua, Māori co-lead and myself, and that worked. And that made me happy too, because it was, we always wanted to kind of embody a treaty partnership approach. Mm. But then almost 2 years ago, we moved to a collective model. So now everybody is equal and we all make decisions together and we all discuss it. Everything goes back to the team. And that is one that I'm most comfortable, that's the approach that I'm most comfortable with. Yeah, because, you know, everyone can say what they want. And if we don't, somebody really objects to something, then we work our way and don't do that thing or think about how we can do it differently. And I really like that. I really like that approach to decision making.
I love how you weaved your experiences of belonging in Aotearoa and just coming to that, you know, the things that's happening outside of New Zealand, all the, you know, things that's shining a light on Muslims in a negative way have impacted you, your experiences here. And there's that drawback, you know, suddenly you don't feel belong, and then the community reaches out, and then there's that constant feeling of you're keeping, you're constantly aware of your differences while also knowing that you are celebrated for being you. And I love the brave hijab story, because I think a lot of people need to hear about that. Because, when the Christchurch attack happened to me, I actually had like a thought, like, where I questioned my hijab, and a lot of Muslim women did feel that way.
Yeah. Mm. And I know there were women that stopped wearing it for a while at least. And it's understandable, the fear, you know.
Mm. And it's good for us to be able to share that fear in a very normal sense, because we don't usually have the opportunity to talk about it. We're just seen wearing it.
Mm. Yeah. And it's interesting. So in 2020, and this was the first major piece of work we did, was we visited 46 towns and cities, and we talked to people about their feelings of belonging here and when what stopped them from feeling like they belong and what needs to change. And when we asked them, you know, when they feel like they belong, the most common answer was when they can be themselves, when they can show up fully, when they don't have to try and conform or fit in. And so while that's our experience of wearing hijab, it's good to recognize that so many people have this experience in very different ways in our country, and how many ways people are making themselves smaller, you know, or changing or constricting just so they can feel safe, whether it's safe in the workplace or safe out in the community, and sometimes even safe within their own families.
And
but
safety.
That ability just to relax and just, this is me, this is who I am, and to be accepted this is one of the biggest factors in belonging.
And safety has to come first before you feel belong. It's, you know, it's higher.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love when you reflected on your, I have to say, leadership or ability to work together, because you don't identify as the word leader, but many, many people will see you as a leader. What, because you work so closely with the community, so how did you step into that community space, especially with your background in accounting?
So, as I said, because my parents were involved in community, so like they were the first members of the Waikato Muslim Association. They were there in the discussions that set up the Federation of Islamic Associations. I used to go to those meetings when the first meetings of Muslim women were happening in the late 80s and 90s. They would take me, my mum would take me. We went all the way to Wellington in 1990, where was the first conference retreat, as it were, for Muslim women, where we agreed to set up the Islamic Women's Council. So it was because my parents took me and I was there. And so I put my name up for, well, they call the chair the national coordinator, but I didn't. Somebody else got it. And so then then they said, oh, no, but you can be secretary. And I was like, good, at least I'm involved, you know, and it probably suited me better. Yeah, it was that. And I think it's also my schooling played a part in that. So when I was in high school, like around 14, 15, I must have been, was when the Springbok tour happened. And that was a huge event in New Zealand's history, you know, with riots and, like, there was some violence around it. And like, it was just this huge thing. And you know, like, as kids, you absorb what's around you. So I had absorbed, you know, we shouldn't miss sports and politics and no, like, blah, 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 all those talking points. And then one of my teachers was very smart. And so they decided to do a debate on whether the Springboks should come or not come. And she put me on the other side of what my views were. And I had to argue that they shouldn't come, which meant that I then had to research about South Africa. And then when I started learning about the history and the Bantustans and 80% of the population not being able to vote, and they couldn't go to the same schools, and the education and Soweto, and oh my God, you know, it was just like, what?
That's a very smart teacher. Just trying to,
And it really changed my view. And even before then, you know, we were living in a Cold War era, so worrying about nuclear weapons and a nuclear war was very real in those times. Northern Ireland and the rights of the Irish people were important. There was so much going on. And so I declared my bedroom a nuclear-free zone, and I put all these stickers because that was a big thing then. So I think I, you know, like through schooling, I did fifth form and seventh form history, and we had a great history teacher. And, you know, and from doing that, I did the New Zealand history module, in both those years we did like a good 6 weeks on the history of here, which meant that I understood Te Tiriti, I understood what was happening before, what happened after, the way that Māori were dispossessed from their land, the way the population was decimated, what that meant then and ongoing through the generations. So all of those experiences as well, I guess, helped me to be an activist, helped me to be want to be someone that spoke out.
And you can't advocate for a community if you don't know the history of the place as well. I love how one thing led to the other.
Yeah, it did. And so that when the World Trade Center attacks happened, like up to then, my involvement had been within my own community, and I was having kids and stuff. And so just like very absorbed, like internally as it were. But when that happened, And I went to a full-day symposium at the Waikato University, and it was just a full day of Muslim bashing. It was so awful. And I came home, and I just felt so afraid for my children. And I thought, you know, I don't want them to grow up in a world where they have to be ashamed of who they are and afraid to hold their head up high. And it's always those things, well, who's going to make that change? Who's going to make a difference? It has to start with yourself.
Mm.
So that's when I started getting more active outside our community. And that's when I helped with a group of women to start Shama Ethnic Women's Centre in around 2001. And then in 2003, I decided to enter politics. And so I did politics for about 10 years. I never got to be an elected representative, but and it was so hard. I found it really tough. But it taught me a lot, you know. Like, I know how government works. I know policy. I could sit in the room. And, again, this is how I learned my diversity. Because so you sit in the rainbow sector and listen to them and their experiences and what they want out of policy. You sit with the disability sector. You sit with the Pasifika people, with Māori people. All of these sectors were there, and they're all talking about their issues and what they need. And that really, you know, helped me understand that, like, we don't have to, like, when we talk about belonging, when we talk about inclusion, I always say you don't have to agree with people, right? You don't have to like what they believe or like how they live.
That's
but you have to
point.
Be able to understand, you know, we have to be able to get along. So it's okay, all right, that's who you are. I'm just going to keep my distance a little bit, but I don't need to harm you.
Mm.
Right? It's just like, how can you create space for each other? In the end, as human beings, we're drawn to the people that are similar to us, whether it's similar values, similar hobbies, whatever it is. But that ability to make space for everyone and see the humanity in everyone, that's what belonging is about for me.
That's really beautiful. I think what a great quote for us to highlight. You know, belonging isn't agreeing with everyone. It's about getting along and just accepting that you're different, I'm different, but still we can live in this world together. And I, you shared a lot about your going into community work and the people who have supported you then. Your parents have been a really important role in also the community groups that you've been a part of. I wonder if there has been any key mentors or people that you looked up to then. As a young person myself, I love talking about this because it just makes me want to keep doing the important work that we do. And who are the important key people that you looked up to?
Well, it's interesting when people ask me that question. And for me, it's like, I don't know, I don't like setting up heroes. And so what I think, like, I remember my time in politics, right? And for people that aren't in politics, they don't understand how the political system works, but it runs off the backs of all these people who get together, meet every month, sometimes every week, organize, and they do this all voluntarily. Nobody is paying anyone. They will pound the streets, dropping leaflets in everyone's letterbox. They will go to drive, fly, go to meetings and argue their policy positions, meet with, you know, elected representatives. You know, when I looked at my daughter who was doing sports or karate, and the parents that would bring the sandwiches, and like some parents who are doing the coaching for free or whatever, like there's all these everyday heroes in our lives that are making this country run and making this country work. So you can look at your, you know, your big world leaders and your, you know, flashy people and people that have genuinely made meaningful change in the world. But for me, it's the small and humble people that are making a difference where they can, how they can. And I always remember this talk at the mosque with the sheikh, he said, you know, the most important person is in your community is the one that you don't even realize he's there until he's not. And then suddenly you see that the mosque isn't as clean as it used to be. It's not being vacuumed as much. The toilets aren't being cleaned. This, you know, and then you realize, oh, that was the person who used to do that. But you never realized took any notice of it or didn't realize. And I think that's, you know, that's our ethos, is that what you can give quietly without needing to be acknowledged and without needing to be seen. And so that's my struggle, is that a lot of my work is visible. And so it's, I find that really hard because, you know, I got a MNZM in, I think it was 2019. And I felt like, well, I did media. Like when the attacks happened, I already had a whole media profile built up from many years. Reporters knew me. People just started calling. And for the next 3 or 4 weeks, all I did was media. And I kept saying, should I come down to Christchurch? And the people there were like, no, there's so many people here. You just stay there and do what you're doing. And so I was visible and I got this award. But like the people that went down there and helped wash the bodies and helped do the janaza and went to the hospital and supported the families and dealt with the police and dealt with, like, those were the real heroes. Mm. Like, those were the people, along with the families that suffered, of course, that need the recognition. So it's always, it's again, it's something that doesn't sit comfortably with me, because I'd rather be that person that works quietly in the background, but I think that's not what was required of me.
But by talking about them right now here, you are bringing light into their contribution. So I think it's really important that you, I'm not surprised. This is the answer you give me when I ask you this.
Well, why I give it is because, like, don't look far and wide for your heroes. Look and support the people around you. And when you see them doing something good, what is it you can do to contribute to that? Instead of waiting for, like, because then we think, oh, you need someone super special or someone with extraordinary qualities. But you don't. Like, those people are around you all the time. We just have to see those qualities in them.
Mm-hmm. And so Inclusive Aotearoa Collective has been running for a few years now, so starting from 2019, and there's been a lot of projects or partnerships that you've done with lots of different groups. We will be talking about the hashtag No Harm Wear with Amnesty International Aotearoa New Zealand soon, but I wonder if you can just give us an overview of what actually Inclusive Aotearoa does, and also some projects that you've done before.
So of our groups that are currently running, Tahono Media is our group. There's a lovely group of community people from across the country who are working on having better representation for minority groups through media. So we're currently busy working on our online symposium, which is the 22nd of October. So if you follow our socials or you want to join our newsletter, you'll get all the details for that. We have a group of women who work in the front lines of systems change. So we have a group that's about solidarity and support for women working on systems change and helping to advocate for them, increase people's understanding of what systems changes. And so we just had these amazing events in May, partnering with System Century in Canada, that were really successful. We have a group that's called the Campaign for Better Digital Policy, and that's where the No Harm Wear campaign has come out of, that collaboration with Amnesty and ourselves. We've had projects that started and finished. So like the Inclusive Faith Project was about how can we develop resources so that faith communities can be more inclusive of disabled people. And that came out of the conversations we had in 2020 when disabled people talked about how You know, they would go to the mall and suddenly someone's kneeling down, laying hands on them, trying to heal them, or how in some communities they're seen as a mark of shame on the parents that the parent got done something wrong. So they were, you know, given this disabled kid as if it's, you know, as if these people are not amazing, wonderful people in their own right. And so then they're left out of family photographs and things like that, and not taken to events and so on. So, yeah, we felt like that was an important area of really trying to change people's minds about how they treat disabled people within their own community with respect and value and seeing the wonderfulness of these people. And, yeah, we're part of other constellations as well. So HUIE is an organization based in Te Whanganui, Wellington, and they're running a community constellation, so we're a partner in that. And alongside that, we do things like our Bridge and Cultures program, and we really want to do one in Otipoti. We're just looking for some support down there, but hopefully. So what we do with Bridging Cultures is partner with the marae and invite, we really want to get ethnic and Pasifika people to the marae to build bridges across these cultures. But generally, when we advertise, a lot of people come and we never turn anyone away. And so we talk a little bit about the history of Aotearoa, then we get the mana whenua and the marae to talk about their history, the local history, and then we have these deep dive conversations around their experiences of discrimination and belonging. So those are amazing events. And then we also do training. So we have a range of, like, we do tetariti training and diversity training and our Belonging Online series. And one of our key things around our training is we come from an empowerment space, because I know a lot of people are a bit nervous about going to these things because they think that they'll be made to feel like they do everything wrong. And our ethos is there's no room for shame or guilt here. Like, it doesn't help anyone. It doesn't lead to any change. And so we design our programs to say, like, no, we're not interested in shaming anyone or making you feel guilty or whatever. What our training is about, how do we motivate you to change? So, so we do a lot of that. And then public speaking, our social media, like, we just use every forum. We do submissions to government for various things. It's hard to encapsulate in just a few things, but anything that we can do to raise awareness or to get people to start motivating them to act to create this kind of change.
What are the key discussions with the climate right now? What are the topics that's coming up for you in Inclusive Aotearoa?
So one of our projects, you know, it came out of a lot of the stuff that's happened, like with the Treaty Principles Bill, the Regulatory Standards Bill, but even before that, you know, taking away funding for training teachers and te reo and all of those things. So we started, one of my colleagues, Atsuro, has started Matiki Mai Book Club. So we call that Matiki Tahono. And Matiki Mai is a report about constitutional transformation that was supported by the Iwi Chairs Forum and led by the late Dr. Moana Jackson and Dr. Margaret Mutu. And so we're really very interested in getting people into that space of how can we transform our political system so that it's working better for everyone. Those things. We did another round of our belonging conversations in the first half of the year. There's a lot of stuff coming out of that, but really people are feeling very insecure around housing and financial security. So those are big issues. So we're hoping to work later this year. One of my other colleagues, Ari, is hoping to work on like a constellation around food security. So, yeah, it's a lot of things. And, you know, we're a small team and we can do what we can do. But it's like that's why we use this collective approach, because once you create these networks, it's the power of people working together that can help create change.
So tell me about No Harmware.
Yeah, so a good chunk of the work that we do is around online spaces. So we've been involved. I was involved with the Christchurch Call, which is around terrorist and violent extremist content online. And it was really started in response to the fact that the terrorist live streamed his attack, and it was seen so widely, and it took so long for Facebook to shut it down and get the copies taken down. And it was seen by children, school children, like even in Christchurch, the school kids that were hiding under their desks were basically watching the live stream of the video. So it was that bad. And it's still, you know, like anything that goes on the internet is very hard to get it removed. So you can still find it if you really want to find it. But, so we understand, like, the kinds of harms that happen online, even though online is great. But we're seeing, you know, gender-based violence. During COVID, we saw the whole, you know, disinformation really rise. Before that, it was conspiracy theories and QAnon and all of those things. So, what a lot of other countries have done, like UK, European Union, Australia, Canada, Ireland, they have digital safety legislation, but we don't have any. And the point of digital safety legislation isn't so much about the content of what people are saying. It's more about the way that platforms are designed, and that the way that they're designing and using algorithms to promote really extreme and awful content. So, and they make money out of that. So they're monetizing because they know that the more outrageous your post is, the more people react to it, which means they'll engage with the platform more so they can sell more advertising. So it's this, you know, and there's, you know, all sorts of different types of platforms. And it's not just social media. We know that online gaming platforms are creating a whole lot of harm. We know various other sites are places where people are being harmed. So we want legislation that will hold the platforms accountable for the way that they design, and to make sure that they think about and put in place measures to keep people safe. And one of the harms that is happening, everyone thinks, oh, you want to take content down, that's what you want to do, free speech. But actually, one of the big harms that's happening is that people aren't able to have their stuff shared. So we've seen plenty of evidence that posts supporting Palestinians in the last couple of years have been shadow banned, have not got the eyeballs on them. We're seeing this with rainbow communities, their content not going up. We've seen the direct targeting of women of color, of other minorities, and like even just women in leadership positions from the incel / manosphere sort of section. So these harms are happening both ways, that stuff is not being taken down that should, and other stuff is being censored that shouldn't. Mm. And so these are difficult decisions to make. So making sure that there are proper frameworks and safeguards, we need those kind of legislation that is for the online spaces, because all of our legislation is really old and not fit for purpose. So that's what the campaign is about. And you can find it on noharmware.nz. But we really encourage people to follow the campaign, to be active, and we're always available to talk to people. So we are doing another webinar around this at the moment. We don't have a firm date, but tentative date is 28th of October. But again, if you follow our socials, it will all be there. But, yeah, we want to have people, because people are concerned, right? And there's plenty of surveys and things that show that people are concerned with what is happening online, but we need them to channel that concern into what can we do productively. And we all know there's not simple and quick, easy solutions for this. It is difficult, but we already have like classifications office, we have the BSA, we have regimes where people are dealing with content and they've done it, they've been working for years. So there's no reason why we can't have something for online spaces as well.
I'm very surprised we don't have...
Online Safety Act. Yeah, we don't have that.
So who do you think is responsible for making sure that everything is safe? And I'm sure there is a lot of answers to this.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be a mixture of government platforms and communities, right? And that's why, like, for the Christchurch call, it's a multi-stakeholder environment where you have all the three parties together. These things have to be negotiated. And I think, you know, it's really hard because the big platforms, we're a very small country. You know, what are we, like half of New York or something?
Insane.
So, like, our power in this space is very limited, and they can just basically laugh at us and say, if you do anything, we'll just remove access or whatever, you know. And we have seen the most recent example of that is Nepal, where they shut down the social media companies that refused to comply and ended up with riots and people dead, so many hundreds injured, a change of prime minister. You know, it is not easy, not easy. And that's why international collaboration is also really important in this space.
Which is why you're working with Amnesty International.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, looking at models from overseas to see what they're doing, what works, what doesn't work, and see what we can put in place here.
So there will be a webinar coming up. What other action points have you got for our listeners on how they can support the work for No Harmware?
Yeah, I think the first thing they should do is head to the website. Yeah, and have a look, because there's some action points there around writing to your MPs and using your own social media and all of these kinds of things. And people are always welcome to get in touch with us if they're interested in joining any of our constellations. Our current round of Matiki Mai Book Club has started, but we're hoping to do two rounds a year. So if you're interested in that, you know, whatever it is, we're happy for people to get in touch, and we'll see where we can slot them into the work that we're doing, and we're happy to be invited to come and talk to you. We can talk to your group online. We're used to doing online trainings. We can come and visit. I was in Whakatane 2 weeks ago doing a keynote there because the council launched their diversity and inclusion strategy. Yeah, we pretty much go anywhere as long as we have budget, and if we can get support with travel and so on, and your organisation has some training budget, then that makes it easier. But we're always available, because for me, it's just like, what I want to change the world one room full at a time. That's what I can do.
Yeah, that's a very good mindset to have as well, because you can't do everything.
That's right.
So there's a lot to look forward to in terms of your work at Inclusive Aotearoa, the campaign that's coming up. What is giving you hope? Because I think it's very important for us to feel like the work that we're doing is meaningful and it will contribute to something. But how what's keeping you going? I think that's the question I want to ask.
I have to say, it is really hard in the current environment, especially globally. It feels really hard, and even locally with the recession. What gives me hope is, you know, the people that turned out for the Toitū Te Tiriti marches and the 300,000 submissions for the Treaty Principles Bill, so many submissions for the Regulatory Standards Bill, the 20,000 people that turned up for the March in Palestine. the March for Humanity. Like, right now, if you're voting in a local government election where it's Māori wards, vote for Māori wards, please carefully, carefully vet the candidates and try and get people in who, you know, who care about belonging, who care about inclusion, who care about the people, and we'll put people first. Talk, ask around, people know people. It's really getting involved. I think, yeah, it's, I think the biggest thing is, again, I go back to faith a lot of the time, is that it's not our job to make anything change. Our job is to, is in the struggle, is in the effort we put in. And I honestly don't believe that any effort is wasted. And so, like, I still remember, I think it was around 2006, 2007, I don't know, it was this My God series. And what they do is every week talk to someone from a particular faith, and it was broadcast on TV1. Well, at least 10 years later or more, I met someone. She says, oh, you don't know me. I'm a social studies teacher in Palmerston North. And you know that thing you did, that My God series? I use that video in my classroom all the time. And it's like, honestly, like when you do something, you don't know
the impact.
The impact is, then we often, we don't even live to see the impact, right? Mm. But for me, it's just like you just scatter seeds on the ground. You scatter them as far as wide as you go, and some of them will turn into plants and flowers and fruit. You never know which one. So that's, I think that's what keeps me going, is just keep pushing as hard as you can. And, you know, if I succeed at nothing, I will be able to say proudly, well, I died trying.
Yeah. And yeah, what I'm understanding here is that even if you don't see the results straight away, who knows, you know, in the future, there will be something, there will be a tree popping up somewhere. So thank you so much, Anjum. I really appreciate this conversation. And yeah, it's healing me as much as it is healing the listeners out there as well, to feel hopeful for this country, Aotearoa New Zealand. And thank you so much for all the work you do as well.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Connecting Cultures Features on RFM.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.